We are very fortunate to be living in times where we have so many things to talk about with COPD, so many options to explore, so many combinations to try, and so many positive things to do in a disease that was felt not long ago to be a bad disease. Well, it's still a bad disease, so it's a global health problem. I think the success that we are experiencing in making people live longer is the problem we're facing by more people having COPD and more people with COPD living longer, and therefore we have to be able to care for them properly so that we can reduce the burden of this disease. As you're well aware, it remains a global health problem, and COPD is projected to become the third leading cause of death not too long from now. So it's not just that, it's that COPD is also a risk factor for other conditions. More importantly, lots of people with COPD, by the time we make their diagnosis, they are actually in a rather advanced stage of their COPD. And by that, I mean your what you call B, grade B. What is grade B? You know about the gold classification, the gold guidelines. These are the ones that most authorities are following around the world, and I follow them just as well because I think that they make sense. They make sense because they are adapting to our needs of understanding the disease, and they are adapting in a way that allows us to better care for our COPD patients. Now, you have the grading system, grade A, B, C, and D. The important thing about the grade B as compared to grade A, if you will, is that the B patients are symptomatic. So if you actually check their CAT score or you check their MMRC, you will find that these patients are symptomatic and therefore they are going to come to you because of their symptoms. And you do your workup and you find that, yes, they have preserved lung function and they're not having exacerbations more than once a year, so not two a year, or they haven't gotten into a hospital or into an intensive care unit or being admitted because of a severe exacerbation. That makes them a B patient. Okay, why is this important? Well, because these patients tend to lose the most. You're quite aware of the Fletcher and Pito graph, which is something that we've been following for the past probably 40 years and saying this is it, this is what we need to do. You start here and you keep going down until you hit that point. If you quit smoking, you readjust the curve and it makes it better, etc., etc. Not so, actually. It turns out that this is a very simplistic and probably wrong, inaccurate way of following the progression of COPD. And that comes back to the phenotyping of COPD. As I said earlier today, that phenotyping is what we are interested in today because that's what's going to tell us which patients can benefit from which combination and what is the expected outcome for such a patient population. Because those patients of a certain phenotype, they may fare differently from others. They may be at a higher risk. They may be more prone to losing than other patients in other categories. And it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we identify those patients so we can intervene in due time to make sure that we either avert or avoid that bad outcome and improve their quality of life while doing so. So it turns out that lung function decline is worse in gold 2, or what you can call, if you will, the grade B. And this is very important because these patients at presentation, they still have preserved lung function. So if they have a preserved lung function, in other words, they should, in theory, if they don't lose anymore, they should be able to lead a normal life in all aspects. And therefore, because they tend to lose the most, they, to me, are the category of patients that are at highest risk and should be addressed more than the others. The downward spiral is something else that I feel we need to keep an eye on. I worry a lot when a patient of mine comes to the office with COPD. I ask him, how are things going? And he says, oh, everything is fine. And I find that he or she, for example, has lost weight. And you can tell that their level of activity is not the same. It turns out that patients, they change what they do to fit what they can do. So if they used to walk, let's say, 2 kilometers, now they walk, 500 meters, and they stop. Or if they used to go to their apartment walking up the stairs, now they take the elevators. And they justify it by whichever thing explanation you can find. My hip is bothering me. I was feeling a bit tired. I was pressed for time. I don't know. Lots of things. They find justifications. Patients like to find justifications for the loss of ability in a way that does not translate into a bad perception of health. They don't want to say that they are getting worse or acknowledge it, especially if they're doing something to worsen that condition. So a smoker who is in category B, who is changing his or her lifestyle to fit what he or she can do now, without stopping smoking, that patient will find any different number of excuses not to say that their condition is worse. So this downward spiral, when they start getting less active, lose muscle, etc., it culminates in a bad outcome, worse exacerbations, and death. So it's very important to try to break that cycle somewhere. What is the current treatment approach in COPD? Well, like I said, in COPD, now it is a paradigm shift over the past years, whereabouts the backbone of treatment of COPD is bronchodilators. It's not steroids. And this is contrary to what we used to say or used to be taught only a few years back. And if you look at, say, the TORCH study, for example, TORCH was one of the major landmark studies in COPD, and the treatment options were mostly steroid-containing, if you will, all the way to the 500 BID, the major dose that was recommended for COPD, with the fluticasone and salmeterol with it. So it turns out that what we need is effective bronchodilation. We don't need to worry much about the anti-inflammatory effect of steroids, because that's not what the money is. As a matter of fact, there are other problems with it, and I will touch upon them in a couple of minutes. So we need inhaled corticosteroids, but their role is becoming more and more limited. Thankfully, we are becoming more likely to pinpoint which patients can benefit from inhaled corticosteroids. And I'm sure throughout the Congress, you're going to hear more about them in detail, more so when you hear about ACOS, for example, or when you look at the peripheral eosinophils and so on and so forth. So the bronchodilators, now we're blessed by the combinations of LAMAs and LABAs. And you know about the guidelines, they tell you when to consider one, when to consider the other, and when to consider both of them together. Like I said, the ICS use in COPD is going to become a thing of the past, probably to a large extent. If you were to be probably accurate, you could say that maybe 1 in 5 patients with COPD, at the most 2, but probably 1 in 5, about 20%, is going to require an inhaled corticosteroids. And we're talking in a stable state, mind you. So when you add ICS to a LABA, of course things change. And there is a major benefit from putting a long-acting beta agonist with an inhaled corticosteroids. But again, studies are surfacing, and there is plenty of evidence stating a fact, probably, or it's going to become a fact, that dual bronchodilation is more effective than using a long-acting beta agonist with an inhaled corticosteroid. And these are things that we did not expect, actually, from the studies. We're seeing levels of improvement with combination beta agonist and muscarinic antagonists that were only seen previously in asthmatics. And the traditional teaching that we grew on was that those patients are suffering from a condition that is essentially, to a large extent, irreversible or poorly reversible, and therefore you do not or should not expect a significant response to bronchodilation. Of course, you're aware of the side effects of steroids more than I am. I have to say that with inhaled corticosteroids, the systemic side effects are limited, and they are subjected to a certain amount, to a certain threshold. So I personally like to use them whenever it's indicated. I make sure that I try to minimize the amount of steroids that I need or that I use. And when I discuss a couple of moments from now, when I talk about Inspire, for example, I'll tell you why this is the case. Are they associated with any specific side effect? Well, the usuals. Cataracts, there is evidence that they do actually increase cataract with time, especially if the patients have been on them long enough. The data for osteoporosis is patchy, depending on which reference you quote and the doses that were used. And it's probably related to the fact that we continue today to overuse steroids in on everyday care of a patient with COPD. Oral candidiasis is a biggie. I find it quite frequent. Maybe I overdiagnosed, I don't know. But I find myself many a time, probably a few times a week, adding an antifungal to a patient that's on a combination medication with a steroid because they have failed to use proper oral hygiene. I was talking about the INSPIRE. INSPIRE is a study that I love. I love it because it gave me some peace of mind that switching to a non-steroid-containing medication is not the end of the world, and I can do it with the confidence that my patient will not suffer from it. So what did INSPIRE do? INSPIRE showed that tiotropium was equivalent in the to the combination of salmeterol, fluticasone for the reduction of exacerbations. What is very interesting, and this is my take-home message actually to myself at least, is that if you look at the patients that had exacerbations in each arm, their treatments were different. So the patients that were on tiotropium and had an exacerbation, they required steroids. Whereas those that had an exacerbation and were on steroids, they required an antibiotic. And it goes down to telling you that the steroid effect on the local microflora that lots of COPDers have altered and are colonized with different bugs depending on the severity is a major factor in those patients requiring an antibiotic when they end up with an exacerbation on this medication. Why does dual bronchodilation work? Because they follow different pathways. So if you look at the beta agonist, for example, you have the beta-2 adrenergic receptor, and the beta-2 adrenergic compound will go and will get attached to that receptor, and you have your relaxation. So this is the mechanism that we're accustomed to, that we use on a daily basis, and now that we have the, if you will, the ultra-labas that are once a day, and they do this exactly. How about the muscarinic antagonists? Well, yes, but they work in a different pathway. They work by blocking the muscarinic receptors, specifically the M3 receptor. And by doing so, they prevent bronchoconstriction, and they actually favor bronchodilation. In other words, you end up by one that is a direct promoter and one that is a preventer of a bronchoconstrictive component, and you have an additive effect. And the beauty of it is that the additive effect is quite impressive and does lead to what I want from my patient's case, which is improving the symptoms of my COPD patient. This is what we all want whenever we're tackling a patient with COPD. And to date, at least at the moment still, we cannot talk about a clear mortality benefit despite the links that we have with exacerbations and mortality. But despite all that, we still cannot flat out say that we have a treatment that will alter mortality in COPD across different strata. The hope is that with different studies showing phenotypes and with proper targeting of a certain phenotype, for example, this can be achieved. And if you look at TORCH, for example, to go back to that landmark study, TORCH, for example, showed that the mortality benefit was near significance. The p-value was 0.052, and it was probably a function of maybe adding some more patients, or I don't know, lots of post hoc that described it, but to date we haven't been able to prove a clear mortality benefit. So essentially, like I said, in gold B, if you will, this is the crux of the treatment is proper bronchodilation, because that's going to slow down the progression of their disease and preserve the good lung function that they have. And this is why I think combining bronchodilators, the olodaterol, which is an ultra-LABA, with the tiotropium, which is the gold standard in llamas, these two actually will actually help us achieve those objectives where it matters most in patients with group B. So, tiotropium, you have lots of data about its experience across the world. And like I said, the studies that I find important to keep pinpointing all the time was the UPLIFT study. And UPLIFT was an amazing study because it is a four-year study. It involved a high number of patients. And it's a study that actually was showed beyond the shadow of a doubt that tiotropium significantly reduced the risk of exacerbation for up to 4 years. It was not a transient effect. It was maintained. And this medication, not only it reduced exacerbations, but also it prolonged the time to exacerbation, and it delayed it by 34% over 4 months, which is a tremendous thing, because this is a better quality of life, less the loss of work, less loss of lung function, etc., etc. This morning, Dr. Riesch was showing that once patients start having exacerbations, and once the frequency of exacerbations becomes shorter and greater and greater, so the gap between exacerbations becomes narrower, those patients are going to end up with a bad outcome. So it's very important to make sure we distance those exacerbations as best we can so that those patients are preserved, because it's a very high demand. What did the Respimat do in terms of delivery of tiotropium? Well, it also did reduce the risk of exacerbation by 31% versus placebo, which is quite impressive and similar to what we are accustomed to. Now, you are aware of the SPARK study, and the SPARK study had the QVA149, which contains glycopyrronium and indacaterol, and it was comparing it to its constituents, glycopyrronium in particular. That was the primary outcome. There was also a third arm of open-label tiotropium, and the secondary outcome was to compare it to the open-label tiotropium. In that, combination showed a statistically significant lower result in terms of exacerbations with its component, glycopyrronium, but even though it was numerically better than tiotropium, that level was not statistically significant with a p-value of 0.09. In terms of the raw data for exacerbations, again, there was no significant benefit for the combination glycopyrronium indacaterol over tiotropium in terms of the percent of patients with exacerbations requiring hospitalization. So this is important, because I think that it does pinpoint to the fact that tiotropium is a molecule that has proven over the years its effect in achieving proper muscarinic antagonism. How about oralaterol and tiotropium? They're both long-acting, and compared to placebo, as you can see, they are almost identical in terms of their effect. And olodaterol in 5 micro and 10 micrograms, they improve the mean FEV1 area under the curve and the trough FEV1 responses over a 48-week period in a similar fashion. It has a rapid onset of action, which is what my patient wants. My patient wants to feel better as quickly as possible. So within 5 minutes, you see the benefit with the olodaterol, and it's maintained throughout the duration of the treatment. It reduced both daytime and nighttime rescue medication use over 48 weeks, as expected from medication in its class. And it was similar to formoterol in that respect. However, one of the differentiating findings was that in terms of its effect on the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, the effect was significant, whereabouts with formoterol it was not significantly different than placebo. As you're aware, the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, a significant change should be a drop of 4 points to make it clinically important. So in that respect, you have the FEV1 benefit, and you translate it into a clinical benefit. Of course, the side effects are always what we're worried about, especially with patients that have comorbidities, and namely the cardiac side effects. And it was good to note that those patients did not actually have any increased side effects in that respect, especially where it mattered most with cardiovascular side effects.